Well, it is a great pleasure here in Vienna to interview Mina Radovic. And we are here, of course, for a conference that you and your mum have just organised. It's great to meet you again.
Thank you, Chris. It's wonderful to meet you. I should say I'm honoured to be doing this with you, and really it's a joy as well.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that we came to this conference. I was happy to be able to support and do the technical side, but it's my mother that did everything.
Do you want to say a little bit about the conference?
Yes, of course. So the conference is Spaces of Memory International Symposium. It's actually my mother is running it, and she's organized everything. It's part of her project that she's running called Film is History here at the University of Vienna. And I've been very happy to be able to do the filming side of it and all the kind of technical support and everything.
And it's worth saying to anybody listening to this that, of course, 5 years ago, at the very beginning of my interviews, I interviewed your mum, of course, when you were both in Edinburgh, of course.
Yes, of course. Yes, that was wonderful. And I'm really happy that you did that.
Yeah. And when you when I first met you, you were just about to embark on a PhD at Goldsmiths. And of course, here you are now, having submitted. So I was suddenly like, what's happened in the last few years? How did that happen so quickly? But do you want to say a little bit about your PhD project?
Yes. Thank you so much. Yes, I've been doing so. Yes, when we last met, I started the PhD, and it was at Goldsmiths. Before, I was at St. Andrews, and I just finished. And the PhD is actually, so it was in the English department, which was actually formed out of the former modern languages department, and they kind of got rid of that and made it all one giant department. So it's in New Cross in London. And my project is specifically, so it's actually German linguistics and film studies. So, and it's focusing on framing totalitarianism, language, and film in 1930s Nazi Germany. So half of my PhD is essentially in linguistics, and I look at text, textual analysis, legal analysis, like analysis of legal texts. And then I look at the second half, film analysis, so, and particularly this relationship between natural language and film language and the transfer from one to the other.
Yeah, and when we were talking the other day, I was fascinated by what you were saying about how often the films from that era are not the ones that people would necessarily expect to find. Because obviously, looking back, we imagine there to be some very sort of dour, Nazi, almost like, documentaries. But you said there's a whole range of genres that the German film industry was making in that era.
Of course, yeah. So there was basically, films people used to tend to think of are films by Leni Riefenstahl and certain Enved Harlan and certain films that are either overtly, glorifying kind of Hitler himself or the Nazi party or with extremely anti-Semitic messages, but they don't often consider the kind of the whole industry context of that time, in which they really produced, in 12 years, more than 1,000 feature films, not to mention documentaries, newsreels, and everything else. So actually, yes, most of the films of the time, and the ones I find particularly interesting, were big musicals, comedies, noirs, dramas, crime fiction, and, and particularly in relation to Britain, there's films like about Sherlock Holmes, and so they're quite fascinating, in terms of what they do. And actually, when you look at films of the time, you can't, if you don't know it's a German film, you might as well think it's one of the classic kind of Hollywood films or another film. So it's very it's very interesting when you don't know going into it what you can expect, really.
And these films easy to get hold of? I mean, obviously, for the purposes of your research, yes. I'm guessing you had to maybe go a little bit, of the extra mile in order to find them. But are they sort of generally available?
Well, yes, I would say a larger majority of them is, and is more, increasingly becoming more available. And that's an interesting question, actually, because quite a lot of them now are on DVD and Blu-ray. The FW Murnau Stiftung is releasing quite a lot of them as well in their own Blu-rays. And that's quite an interesting topic, which I'll come back to. But there is a number of them that are still banned, so formally by law and in Germany in particular, so they can be only really used for research purposes, and that's about 45 or 50 of them. And those are interesting too, because not all of those are necessarily, all films with overt messages, and that's what's interesting, how they select those. Of course, some are, that's not to mention, there's quite an interesting number of them that are, like Jude Zeus and many others. But there are a number of them that are interesting, and so. But having said that, the ones that are released are also filmed by, let's say, Veit Harlan. So that's an interesting moment when, like, a film like Jude Zeus is banned, but then all his other films are available. So you think, and they're also available in Blu-ray, and they're without any context, without anything. So it's interesting how some of those films are becoming recontextualized and perhaps people are seeing them, but without any context whatsoever at the time. So this is a moment when, you know, it's really a question of, are they really getting what function these films served?
And were you familiar with them before? I mean, obviously, as with any PhD project, you always sort of, you have to have some idea about what you're going to do over 3 years or whatever it is. And then, of course, you discover more and more text, and then your whole project is reframed. But in your case, you know, how familiar were these with you? Was it, you know, a labour of love? Did you sort of make all these unexpected discoveries? Was this the project that you initially expected to be doing?
Thank you. So I started because there was a great influence from my mother in terms of that she studied, she did a book on ideology and quite on transnational cinema and ideology. And so she talked quite a lot about ideology, and I had discovered through her work Hannah Arendt. And then I had actually come to Vienna about 6 years ago and was doing a course specifically on Hannah Arendt, who's a fascinating figure. And in terms of her research on totalitarianism, how ideology works, and especially how oppressive ideologies work, you know, to make people change behavior, change ways of speaking, acting, was fascinated me. And I noticed it also a certain applicability in everyday life, even nowadays, from what she said. It's something that resonates. So that was one aspect. Another aspect was the fact that in the final year at St. Andrews, I did a course on language and ideology in East and West Germany. And that was run by Dr. Christopher Biedem, who's now recently retired, but he's a great linguist. And he basically did this course where he showed us how words, like he even gave us dictionaries, how they defined concepts in East Germany and West Germany, exactly the same concepts. Mm-hmm. And one I liked was the Arbeitgeber, Arbeitnehmer. It's like the employer, employee, but they'd, in German, it's like the work giver, work taker, but they had the opposite functions. So the obverse meaning. So the one that gives the work. So the Arbeitgeber, that's the one. Usually that would be called the employer. So that would be in West Germany, but in East Germany that was the employee because they're giving their own labor. So it's very interesting how they define. So this got me really thinking about how ideology is defined and how exactly the same things can be covered even by media, but in totally different ways. So there were these kind of running parallels, and of course I've always been working, studying, and also very interested in love film from an early age. So I thought, okay, and then how does this work through film? Because film obviously has such a big impact on people. And how did this work? So before, I would guess I would have seen some films. While I was at St. Andrews, I also saw films by Veit Harlan. I saw Jude Zeus and films like that. Also Leni Riefenstahl and some other key films from the era. And what I found interesting particularly before was Douglas Sirk. Because Douglas Sirk was obviously so he made great kind of films during the 50s, 60s in Hollywood.
All That Heaven Allows.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. So, but he obviously, he started his career in Germany, Nazi Germany. So he made a number of films there too. And it's interesting to see how those compare and like what he does there. So I kind of like, that's how I kind of went back. I was like, I liked, you know, his films from the 50s. We did like, yes, All the Heaven Allows, Imitation of Life. So I thought, okay, how did he start? And then that gets you really thinking about, you know, how, but ultimately what the question that I was really, that stayed with me was, can we have totalitarian poets? And that was really something that interested me. And my answer was kind of through the research. And I know that's not sometimes people academically always look to become more dialectical or, you know, to have really complicated answers. But through my research, I found out that no, you can have poets under totalitarian regimes. Absolutely. So that's a question, like, regardless, I'm not here talking about Nazi Germany. I mean, any totalitarian regime, you can have poets emerge. But such a thing as a totalitarian poet, I think it's very difficult because I don't think poetry is something that works when ideology comes into the place.
Yeah, and you mentioned Douglas Sirk because just a night or two before I came here, I saw an advanced screening of Pearl, the horror film, which is the prequel set in 1918 to X, which came out last year. And it's so Sirkian in the sort of oversaturated colour, and it's sort of a horror film but clearly drawing a lot of sort of ingredients sort of from the 50s but set in 1918. So there's a lot of, and because it's the precursor to a film that was set in the I think in the modern day, but which is drawing very much on the sort of 70s with the, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and so on. It's sort of very much a hybrid film. But what you're saying is really interesting, that actually then, so Douglas Sirk, and I didn't realise that he had that European background, but and the way that informed his American melodramas, and how you're effectively looking at some of the sources there, or sort of looking at films that are very much of that kind of ethos.
Yes. So, well, Douglas Sirk is an interesting figure. I mean, he's one example of, I think, many. One other, I mean, actually, to say something about him, I always was interested in terms of how, you know, this layer of, people often say entertainment, but how this moment of kind of these big epics, world, I would say world building films. That was kind of the word I used, kind of, or what I used in the PhD, because it was those films that kind of open up worlds for you to see and so on. But I was always interested in terms of how they do this. So I compared explicit, implicit. So those ones that are overt, and I would say those are films by Leni Riefenstahl. And then those more implicit ones that build worlds, but essentially they're not about so much like whether they give you an overt message that's, for example, anti-Semitic, but about the fact that they frame the world through ideology. So that's what's interesting for me. And that in someone like Douglas Sirk, for example, or also... and of course, there's like measures of that, but also in a filmmaker like Gustav Utsitsky, I analyzed him quite a lot. People don't really know about him so much, but he made a great number of films during the 30s and 40s. And one I analyzed, for example, was Uproar in Damascus from 1939, and that's kind of a film set in, you know, in Syria at the time and after the First World War, and it's a very kind of, it opens up, you know, it takes you beyond the European context. It's a very big, in a way, it, you know, it feels like a melodrama, a great epic, and then suddenly, you know, you have all these layers of it, both in language, but also film language in particular. That reveal kind of this kind of ideological alignment with Nazi ideology.
Yeah. And it's probably worth saying a little bit about your masterclasses. Now, I mean, lockdown had many, a huge number of disadvantages, but one thing that you were able to do was bring together a community of people, including filmmakers, to talk about their work. And I had the great privilege of attending at least one of them, as I recall, during possibly 2021. Do you want to say a little bit about that and some of the people that you managed to recruit?
Thank you so much. So we did, yes, this is a part of Liberating Cinema UK. I initially started this at the university in St. Andrews, and this was initially a program at the university that I wanted to, you know, I really yearned to kind of, to have a community space where people could watch films, and films they hadn't seen before, particularly, you know, to rediscover cinema, and really go beyond, you know, challenge both ourselves, but also everyone who's joining us. And so this is how it started, and then I registered it as a charity afterwards, and we now have a board of trustees, and it's functioning as a non-profit charitable organization. So our kind of, if I say our aims, and I really like that, it's a kind of representation, restoration, exhibition, world cinema heritage. And so the masterclass series is a great component, and one we initially started with. So it was when we had our launch as a charity, we had the first one, it was a masterclass with Amos Gitai, who actually joined us also at this conference. So, and a workshop on the Holocaust in the Czechoslovak New Wave. So, and this is obviously the Czechoslovak New Wave is also a very well-known kind of moment in film history, but particularly how they dealt with the Holocaust, they did something quite special. But with Amos Gitai, so Amos Gitai was the one that initially started the masterclass series. And for anyone who might listen, his work is really wonderful, and he has a kind of great range. He's also, I mean, he works in art, and he's as a pedagogue as well. But his films are really beautiful, and they're really poetic. And films like Kippur or Ana Arabia in particular, I would say. And in this case, we also showed the film about Yitzhak Rabin, the assassination, The Last Day. Mm-hmm. So he's an interesting figure in terms of how he's able to really combine and look at critically both kind of... spaces and particularly political realities, but also to go further and to really be poetic and to really show poetry through his work. Yes, so that's how it started. And then initially, and then we went and we kind of had master classes periodically and further on. So we had people like Pedro Costa, Ahmed El Manouni, who came and joined us just in Morocco in London, from Morocco in London, and Fabrice Aragno, who was, of course, recently, Jean-Luc Godard recently departed, and he was the cinematographer on all his late films. So we had people like them, and of course, and other filmmakers like the Iranian filmmaker Narges Abyar, who's she's a great filmmaker in Iran, making wonderful work. To kind of Yugoslav classics, also we had a Goran Marković, who is like the kind of epitome of this generation, often called the Prague School or the Czech School, and there are kind of these new Yugoslav filmmakers that emerged like in the 70s and 80s. I should distinguish from new Yugoslav film because that's from the 60s, but I mean this kind of younger generation of filmmakers that emerged.
Yeah.
And so it's a kind of it's really about connecting really different cinemas people don't get usually a chance to see, and people they don't usually get a chance to interact with, because I always wanted that. I mean, when I was at university, but also before university, I always thought how wonderful it would be to meet people and to meet filmmakers and to do that. And often, we talked about this before as well, the inaccessibility of it all, the fact that often, you know, you have to go through all these loopholes or, you know, or jump over so many fences to meet somebody. And even then, you don't know whether you're going to have a proper conversation. So this was what led me. I thought, okay, it would be wonderful to do this, and it's free as well. So this is all free, and we do them kind of accessibly. And so I, you know, doing master classes with people like, you know, Pedro Costa, Amos Guitar, all these, it's for me, I really, it's resonated, I think, also with people. So I'm really glad.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful thing that you're doing, and particularly as well that filmmakers are prepared to give up their time in that sense and not expect a fee, that, you know, because I suppose there's always the sort of the thought of, you know, I'd like to get so-and-so, but, you know, well, you know, maybe they're going to expect a huge payment for their services. But the fact that you've managed to get people to do it for free and for actually people to benefit, and, you know, for the filmmakers of tomorrow kind of thing, then that actually just sounds like, you know, on every level, it's a real hit. And you've done, well, more than half a dozen of them, I think, so far, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. There are more. So, I should say also, since this conference, thank you so much. This conference also, Yelena Popovic, who joined us here from Man of God, we did a masterclass with her. Yeah. But what you said about the accessibility of it free, so on both sides, and the fact that they're, you know, doing this also in a way for great and a wonderful charitable purpose, but at the same time that people can access it for free and talk to them and have this conversation. But of course, there are some filmmakers that, you know, that there is, they might expect a fee, but that's to be expected. I mean, especially if they're traveling from somewhere far away. But yes, I mean, we continue to build with and to partner with other organizations, and mostly, I mean, film archives and museums and the non-profits.
And I'm struck as well because, as I know from your mum's work, that, for example, Pretty Village, Pretty Flame, you know, films that you grew up with. So the films that your mum was studying were also films, and you were telling me the other evening about your experience of watching that sort of on multiple occasions. But do you want to say a little bit about your own background? Do you want to say a little bit, for example, about where you were born and some of the experiences that you had, and how film in a kind of way has sort of brought together a lot of those particular tensions and challenges that are part of your own background and heritage?
Thank you so much. Yes, so I thank you for asking this question, because I think, so I was born in Belgrade in Serbia. At the time it was still Yugoslavia, and so there was an immense, and it was kind of happening, you know, there was the civil war and everything during the 90s, what was happening. So and I was growing up in Belgrade, and then we had also the country was still, I mean, it was still connected to Serbia and Montenegro, so everything and everyone was still living, you know, in the same space. Of course, there were, you know, the separation, everything did begin to happen and happened. But the culture, I mean, the cultural heritage, what I find about cinema really important, and what I've been doing, is kind of the Yugoslav cinema heritage is really important, and it's something that I saw kind of almost disappear. And Pretty Village is a great film because it starts with the moment where it says, so whereas films like Underground, which was very famous and won the Palme d'Or and so on, said dedicated to a country that no longer exists, what Dragovic did with Pretty Village, he said dedicated to a cinema that no longer exists. And I recently remember that because I kind of had forgotten that moment. Because I had gotten, you know, you have now so many academics that like to talk about different national cinemas and to, in a way, separate, which in some cases can be understandable if there are, you know, there's a link back to the very beginning of film and, you know, a certain amount of heritage. So that's understandable. But I'm not quite, you know, I didn't quite always quite understand the separation kind of policy, because that's not something, you know, the Yugoslav kind of heritage was quite unique itself. And I remember Dragovic that he said that, so it's dedicated to a cinema that no longer exists. So in a way that I guess did in a way very much shape me, and my mother was doing, I mean, this is a moment, obviously I was much younger, but I did watch these films kind of, I don't know if this is a great moment to say I've seen these films younger, but yes, I mean, it did definitely have a big influence in the sense, I mean, she obviously always gave me context and it was, and I kind of understood, and also it was my, you know, sometimes my grandparents would be watching and they would have their own input, or my grandfather, I remember, who departed from us several years ago, he basically had this intake, particularly on the character of Bata Živojinović, who's kind of, I told you about this, the one of the great Yugoslav stars who was in like 350 films. And so his character was also this moment, there's this great moment when he drives out of the tunnel called Brotherhood and Unity, and is this epitome both of his star persona, the cinema, and also this horrible moment of the civil war and the destruction of the country. So that's an element of it. But of course, there are so many elements in the film, and that's what we had spoken about before, that the film works on so many layers, and that's what's beautiful about it, because it's not just a film about, you know, the social context, it's also about the cultural context, the political context, religious context. So there are so many layers to the film. Every moment, in a way, is its own layer. And that's what I guess now I'm saying that, but when I was watching it, I experienced it much more viscerally. I think it's a great film for somebody who wants to understand what happened, because it kind of gives you a sense of the context and in the face of his destruction.
Because it was made sort of mid-90s, is that
right? Yes, exactly. It's made in 96. So it was made just after everything had happened in Bosnia and the Dayton Accords were... but I think it was actually still shot while everything was happening. So... So it was made, yes, in 1996, and the reception of the film was quite interesting because it was, in some cases, you know, in some cases it was totally rejected, and in other cases it was widely accepted. So I remember critics like in Variety called it better than any film Kubrick had ever made, and in London it was shown quite a lot, and the British Film Institute voted it on its greatest films, war films of all time. So it had also an interesting reception. But I mean, for me, again, when I go back to that, it was a film that very much, I think, I understood also the kind of... It's a great, at the same time, war and anti-war film, if I can say. So it's a... It tells you, it shows you the, kind of the various layers, but it shows you also the horror of it. So, and one scene, if I can say, and that's perhaps the last thing I'll say, is the beginning. You have this moment where the character is kind of in a surreal shot, getting taken out of the plane, who's just been at the battlefield, and you see this moment where you hear the basketball hitting the hoop, and you constantly hear the basketball, and it's against the shot of his bloodied head, and he remembers his friend and playing in basketball in Sarajevo, and so it's this moment where it really transcends all boundaries, and it shows you that despite they're formally on different sides, that he dreams of his friend and that boundaries don't exist.
As you're talking, what really strikes me is this sort of notion almost as cinema as catharsis, cinema as therapy. I'm trying to think, I mean, against that kind of backdrop, and having watched that film clearly and studied it, researched it and so on, certainly in your mum's case, is there a sense that the multiple layers, the multiple revisits, both, you know, and watching it perhaps with other people, with family members, etc., as well as studying it for research purposes, does that unpack lots of layers? There's this whole thing about cinema and identity, particular films that have followed me across my whole life, and there's something hugely autobiographical about the way that we interact with film. But it sounds like in your case, it's like a perfect kind of synthesis and a kind of, in view of the war-torn sort of background of all of this, a sort of a necessary film to watch.
Yes. Well, that's a wonderful word you said, because I think necessary film is what I would say that actually is the most for this film, because it really is, and therapeutic as well, because I think a lot of people, and I met a lot of people who said they've seen this film, and it was, whereas other films, you know, from the period, I mean, they're great films, but this other films may not be so powerful, but this film resonated with people, and that they took something from it. So in terms of your question, I mean, I would say it's definitely, for me, it was necessary in terms of just, without, obviously, I didn't expect that. I didn't, you know, I was very young, so I didn't know, you know, what I would be expecting. And, you know, then I actually learned about some of the context through the film, and that was really helpful. And then when you kind of build around that. But I would say also from experience, from showing it to people, it's an interesting film because, for example, there's this character of the American journalist. And when I had showed it in a screening at St. Andrews, you know, some of the American and even colleagues and friends, they had their own intake through the journalist. So it was like a totally different focalization point from somebody who's maybe slightly outside the context formally. But they had the way in, and it resonated with them. So it's very, I mean, for me, I mean, it's a very powerful film. And yeah, it can show what cinema can do.
Yeah, and are you or your mum in any way, or have you been in contact with the filmmaker, with the director over the years? Is there an awareness of the impact that this film has made? I'm assuming the answer must be yes.
You mean the impact so on me personally, on us,
well,
or
well,
on,
well,
the,
kind
on
of,
people?
Well, indeed, the fact, the input on you and many people like you, but whether you've then been motivated to seek out the person making that film to have a dialogue, to have a conversation. It feels, I mean, and obviously you do masterclasses as well, but I'm imagining that that the film is not just something that you sort of, that is there in isolation, that there is dialogue, which was a very sort of key word that I thought really came to the fore in the conference that we just had. So has there been that dimension?
Yes, so I would say the 2 points wonderfully. First of all, yes, my mother had initially been in touch with Dragović when she was doing her PhD, so she had known him quite well at the time. Well, in terms of interviewing him and actually getting his, while she was writing, she was, you know, obviously Yes, like putting forward questions to him and about the film. So that's how they were in touch. And then we had established contact then as well over the time. And now recently, I've been actually seeing about one point to do a masterclass with him. So this is actually will be forthcoming for everyone who might like to join. So it's actually like I really wanted to do that for some time, but it's actually finding the perfect opportunity. Mm-hmm. But of course, yes. And she actually recently also did something with him and a longer conversation where we learned a lot more about the film. For instance, one of the details I liked was that once he arrived in Bosnia, where he filmed some of he tore up most of his script and started again. So he really is a person. I mean, those films, I think they did resonate with people. I mean, he's one of the most well known from the generation of the 90s and forward. He's probably the most well known Serbian filmmaker. From the 90s onward. So he's quite well known across the Yugoslav successor states, but also beyond, I believe. So because he also went to Hollywood for some time, but had returned back to Serbia. So and then it continued his work. So I mean, he's very prolific, and his recent film was at Locarno. But I think this film deserves perhaps beyond academic certain contexts to be more seen by everyday public general audiences. I did recently vote for it in the Sight and Sound poll for the film. So I was very happy because I was able to really put this film forward and say this is a wonderful work and worth seeing.
Yeah, and did that make it into the top 100?
No, so it was actually interesting. The poll was very, I would say it was very interesting. They had like quite a number of diverse films that I enjoyed getting in there, like Sarah Gomez and certain African filmmakers and particular films like Sambizanga and another one. So I was happy those kind of films. And The Hour of the Furnace is another great film. But I mean, the top 100 in a way was the ones that you would, I guess people are very, they're very much film buff films in a way.
But with the exception perhaps of number one, which I think wrong-footed a lot of people. Yeah, I've never seen it. Yeah.
It wrong-footed, you said?
Completely wrong-footed. Oh, really? I'd never heard of it. At least, because that sort of shot from, I'm not sure where it appeared in the past, but of course we were always used to having a couple of those, Hitchcock's, I think, was it Vertigo that often appeared sort of at the top, or The Searchers, I'm sure, was often at the top. And was it Citizen Kane? I can't remember, but certainly there were certain films that you expected to see there. And then the top 10 was a far more diverse list than we've had in previous decades.
Yes, well, certainly, I would say so. But I think also, and they also had quite a surprising number of kind of new films, which was, films by Celine Dion, the films like Portrait of a Lady on Fire or Get Out, and so those were kind of really unexpected. But at the same time, you had, so Chantal Ackerman, I mean, I watched quite a number of her films, so I wasn't so surprised that this film, there was a surprise, but if I differ slightly, I thought perhaps, because I noticed that it's in certain film circles, she's revered in a very, very, very much high, and for many films, rightly so. But we studied this film in film school as well, so we had, I had actually been taught it quite a lot. So by the time it came to the poll, I thought, oh dear, I thought, okay, I've seen it, I've seen a lot of this film, so I understood like why, where people came from, but perhaps I did think there should be a little more perhaps diversity still, because there is still despite the fact that I was happy that many filmmakers from places like Cuba and from South America, Central America, and Africa were made it into the poll. There's still, a great amount of, there was no Yugoslav films whatsoever. And then some Czechoslovak films, but that was more to do with Vera Chytilova, who's a wonderful, wonderful filmmaker. But some, I believe it was Eva Mazierska, who made a point in studies in Eastern European cinema that perhaps filmmakers like Vera Chytilova were included because they're women filmmakers as well. So there's this other dimension to their work, whereas some of the kind of really gems of whether it's Czechoslovak cinema or Yugoslav cinema or even Polish cinema are still perhaps unjustly neglected.
Yeah, and what is really quite striking is that you were very young when you moved to the UK, but you've carried with you all of this tradition. You've worked on it. You've turned it into a PhD thesis, and you share that. There's that sense of through the masterclasses, a clear sense that you're not just somebody who's sort of shutting yourself away, working on this project, and maybe there'll be a book in the future, but otherwise people don't really know much about what you're up to. But there's a real sense, and I know you've sort of met Scorsese, haven't you? But I mean, but his work on heritage and film preservation, it sounds like a very similar kind of labor of love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, actually, thank you for wonderfully saying that. So in terms of, there's this phrase in academia I feel all the time, you know, impact.
Yeah.
They always talk about this. How does your research have impact? And I really like this. I mean, people are always like, have this kind of weariness about this word, but I always loved it because I thought, well, that's actually like, it, in this, not in the sense, perhaps not in the bureaucratic sense, some of these people mean, but in the sense of, you know, of course your work has to, like, you know, why am I writing so much, or why am I doing anything if it's not going to resonate, or like, what if we're not going to share, if we're not going to share that and learn something together? So my always, I don't know if that I would say ethos, or what I wanted to do was always to, you know, get people to connect and to share this and to speak to one another first and foremost. And to learn from one another. Because I noticed that, you know, people have certain ideas about certain places and cultures, and then they meet them and learn. You know, even I've seen that in myself. If I see, in, you know, an Iranian film for the first time, or once I did, or a Sri Lankan film, or a film, you know, a film from Mali, or wherever it will be, it really changes your perspective. You feel like you know a little bit about the people, even if they're not good films. And that's the part I want to emphasize. Even if, of course, the idea is to show wonderful, excellent films, but even if they're not necessarily good films, they always give you, they tell you something, they teach you something. And yes, Scorsese, I mean, this is wonderful in terms of, in a way, a catharsis as well. I did see him when I started, so I did the FIAF school in archiving and film preservation restoration in Bologna, and that year when we were there for the school, he did a masterclass, so that was, in a way, the meeting, it was really wonderful. But I mean, of course, to have actually a conversation, and, you know, to that, it's through the Film Foundation. So the film, I would, and that's something, you know, that I hope will be forthcoming, but I've always, we all know, I mean, how much he is filming all the time, despite, you know, or actually not despite, perhaps even because, wonderfully, with at the age he is at, he's even more productive than ever.
He's 80,
so,
yes.
Exactly, so even more productive than ever, and I mean, yeah. So yeah. I would say I really respect and value the work they do, and I think there's always more work to be done.
Yeah, and do you want to say a little bit about your undergraduate time? Because you were at St Andrews, weren't you? And you did a degree. Was the degree in film studies?
Yeah. So the degree was in film studies and German, and that included language, literature, and linguistics, of course. And I mean, St Andrews was a wonderful place. When I had started, we had the two professors who were the directors of the film department in that case were Professor Dina Erdanova and Professor Robert Burgoyne, who were really, you know, they kind of brought the best out, I think, out of also film students, and also the kind of, they set a certain example, which was very inspiring. And that goes also for my German department, where I had really great, wonderful teachers like Dr. Andrew Cusack and Dr. Christopher Biedem, I had already said, and many others. I don't want to if they ever do listen, I do really love, you know, our whole German department and modern languages and film studies. So, and I really value to have both sides. And I say both sides not in a kind of divisive way, but actually the opposite. It actually made a bridge for me because I could learn about, like, you know, through German, and then I was able to do this through film studies as well. So I actually try to always connect, and that's why the PhD is also, I guess, connecting both disciplines.
Yeah, and did you find as well that in doing film studies and German as well, were the films that you were interested in, which you clearly, you know, made this wonderful project out of, were they the sort of films that other students on the course, or indeed in terms of the tutors on the course, what they were disseminating? Did you come into contact with a lot of films that were outside your kind of comfort zone? Did you feel that you were sort of teaching the teachers as well as the other students because of your very rich heritage that you were bringing to the degree?
Oh dear, I don't know. Well, I don't know. Thank you so much. I don't know if it's fair for me to comment to my own self, you know, if I'm teaching the teachers, but that would be a little bit going a little too far. But I did always like to come to the teachers with suggestions and to talk. And so I, perhaps in some of them were really welcoming. Like, you know, Professor Danova was always very wonderfully supportive. So we had wonderful conversations and dialogue. Certain teachers, you know, perhaps would be, find it a little. I don't know how they found it, but perhaps it's, you know, when you have a film student who's always coming and telling you, "What about this film? What about this film?" It always depends on the teacher themselves. Yeah. So, but I definitely did, because I always found it. I really liked meeting teachers, and I mean, obviously, fellow students and everyone. So because I really wanted, you know, people to watch films and me to watch. Like, in response to your question, I did see, so in terms of the German films, that we did do some classic German examples, like from film, and from the silent period, Werner Herzog and many others, but not the Nazi period. That wasn't like something that was covered. And that's another part of it that I think, you know, in film studies courses should be covered. Because, you know, I always think there's a moment when people will interact with some kind of totalitarian regime and the cinema it produced. And they should know how to go about that. So that's something, I mean, that's not obviously, that's something that perhaps it should be built on slightly. So, the last point about your question was, I always did make an effort to challenge myself in terms of the films I watched. So I would, anyone who knew me or lived with me, they knew that I would be going through, like, you know, if we had a week on the British New Wave, I would watch, like, not only the, like, main film, but every additional film and, like, every, and beyond that, more films. So, and even the films that preceded it, like Free Cinema, which is a great moment in British film history, and obviously the Ealing comedies. So I always tried to do that, and I guess the phase, or I would say the phase that, but people that bothered my fellow, or not bothered, but that was perhaps, quite funny to my, to both also the people that were living with me and my, both my family and also my, my friends, where it was the fact that when I started watching Bollywood films, like all the time, and then you have, you know, obviously like dance, music, choreography, and I, you know, I think people often would just come in and just see this, like, you know, like, out of the world scene, and I, you know, oh, he's on Bollywood now, that would be the question. So, but it, I mean, no, I really enjoyed it as a whole. So I have to say, at St. Andrews, it was like I had the space and the opportunity to do that, and I was really happy to be able to.
And were you ever able to watch a lot of these films in theatres? Because we were talking the other day actually about a film that was made in 2019 from Bhutan, in so sort of Eastern Himalayas, and it was the Lunana, the Yak in the Classroom. And I think you saw it at the London Film Festival, and I only saw it in Canterbury in March 2023. Aside perhaps from film festivals, have you had the chance to watch a lot of these films that you're interested in the cinema? What's the primary means for watching film?
So, I mean, cinema is always the one I've loved the most. And I grew up going to the cinema. So and it was always, I loved going to the cinema. And that was actually, I would say, even my, and of course, although I'm, you mean, compared to, you know, especially my mother's generation, older generations who just, you know, went to the cinema all the time. And now, obviously, I grew up with also digital technology and so on. I always still, I would say, also my generation and friends, and we were, like, still, I would say, a generation that went to the cinema. Yeah. There were DVDs, of course, videos, and that was an aspect of it. And actually, even videos and DVDs seem out of date now. You know, when you say something, I was very much, we were very much used to getting films, you know, going to, even such a thing as going to, like, the rental store. And I have to say that because Vogue Video in Edinburgh, this is another cultural moment of, like, I would say for really for Edinburgh, for Scotland, even for the UK, I think it was one of the last video stores, perhaps the last video store. And it was run by a wonderful, wonderful man. He was kind of a local legend. He came from Iran in the 70s after the revolution, or during the revolution, or even before, perhaps. I'm not quite sure. And his wife was Scottish, and they made this wonderful community out of this, and he had stories to tell. And actually, I'm making a documentary still about him. He really had a huge impact, I would say, as well. So, but of course, going to the cinema, and then there was a moment when I wanted to watch all these films that weren't accessible in the cinema, where, you know, I had to go a little bit beyond. So I would say at St. Andrews, often I found even films in our film library, or I would be finding films. Certain films I would even find online, and that's one of the benefits, I would say, although there are many, you know, things that perhaps don't benefit so well. One of the benefits of, like, online libraries now is that a lot of film archives have started putting their collections online. So, and like that's in the case of the Yugoslav films, or also actually, I would say, particularly Polish cinema. I saw that there's like 35mm online, particular site that the kind of Polish Cinematheque, the EU, have supported, and now they put like a huge amount of Polish film heritage online for free, restored. Yeah. And it was part of a huge project. So that's an aspect. But I would say definitely I would be cinema going, and I was really, the only thing is I always want, and this is part of the work that also motivates me with liberating cinemas, I really want to show films kind of also in the cinema, yeah, again, and films that you don't have access to. And that was one thing that was, I guess, I was a little bit saddened by, because sometimes you would have to go to festivals to see certain, yeah, films, or to see retrospectives, yeah, even. And of course, you know that the Film House has now recently closed in Edinburgh. And there's a question of what the film festival will look like this year. But it was a shock to everybody, because it was the last independent cinema. So, and even the work they were doing now has been shut down. So it's a question of what will happen next. Mm. But in bigger centres like in London, or whether in continental Europe, it's a different question. But it's always in Scotland particularly, it's important that these films get seen on the big screen.
Yeah, and this takes well into, as we start to wrap up, on nostalgia, because I mean, obviously everything that you're saying, it's suffused with this. It's this sense of the past well before you were born. You know, the study of 1930s German films and so on. But I'm interested in the role that nostalgia plays in your life on multiple levels. And particularly in the light of the experiences of Serbia, this whole notion about whether it's possible to be nostalgic sometimes about you know war, about negative experiences, because I suppose not everybody who watches a happy Disney film or something is going to come away sort of feeling wonderful. They might sort of feel that, you know, that there are parts missing, but war films particularly as well. That, I mean, both of my grandparents were heavily involved in the Second World War. They met during the Second World War, and in some ways that horrible experience of war was in later life. My grandfather turned it into a love story, effectively about the romance of meeting, and you know if they hadn't met, I wouldn't be here today. But is that a difficult concept? Is it possible to sort of see almost something redemptive about those negative experiences?
I think so. Actually, the wonderful thing what you said, and your story sounds beautiful. But I think so. One thing I should say is I don't think it's possible to be. I don't think it's a good thing to be nostalgic about war itself. So that's one thing to say first of all. It is possible, I think, to be nostalgia. I mean, I would see, and we had also Andrei Tarkovsky at this conference. Mm-hmm. Andrei Tarkovsky, the son of Tarkovsky, and also a great filmmaker in his own right, mm-hmm. whose really masterpiece was the film Andrei Tarkovsky, A Cinema Prayer. But he, the way Tarkovsky the defined nostalgia, or not defined in a way, if you watch his film Nostalgia, mm-hmm. and you see the final shot, that idea of, it really shows you that home, for him, I mean, was a geographical place, yes. but at the same time, it was much more. So it's really a space of the heart, and it's something that's eternal. So it's even possible, I mean, and this we come to this as well in a kind of your subject is religion and film. So and it's this moment of like that you can be nostalgic for also the future. Yeah. So this is, and I mean, for me to respond to your question very simply, I would say it's also nostalgia. Not in a, people tend to use the word very superficially. But in the sense of, in that deeper sense of being carrying within that moment and the knowledge that people can, and it's a fact that they do live together. And even now, you know, people now may have different views, but, you know, the fact that that can be and is a reality. And for those who it isn't a reality, that it can be and that it is, mm-hmm. is something wonderful. So that's kind of what that's how I see it. So it's not so much about let's bring back Tito or let's bring back, whoever. It's more about the connecting connecting people.
Yeah, and no, I think you're absolutely right, and I think also it's the way that cinema can be a beacon of hope. It can be that even if sometimes there is this mismatch, this disjuncture between the REAL and the REEL, that actually it's those gaps. Actually, that was one of the things that we were talking about in the conference itself, about where the gaps are and how you fill the gaps, and the way that sometimes we, irrespective of what the film is in itself, it's what it does to people, the impact on people, that actually that's the conversation point. It's not the film in itself. It's the it's the possibilities that it engenders. But did you ever imagine when you were a lot younger that you'd be doing any of this? I mean, obviously you're very young yourself. You have many years ahead of you. But is this what you always hoped and expected to be doing? And what are your plans for the future?
So it's really funny. That's a great question. I had actually found, and I couldn't believe this myself. Like when you say it like this, I would say initially no, because I would say for film yes, because I always had something drive with film. And then my mother was always a huge, immense support to me in every way. And supporting me with languages, because she was the one that said, Mina, you learned so quickly English, and and it's but you grew up bilingual, you had talent for languages. So she always supported me in this direction as well as film. So that in that sense, but I had actually found, so this is a nice little detail. I found something from primary school in Edinburgh. A note we had like, where do you expect to be in 15 years? Really, we had this. I couldn't believe it. And I mean, this is the great part about the schooling system, and I couldn't believe it. So, and it said, literally, I read it like during last year, and it said, I expect to be doing postgraduate studies in like, I think it was, I don't know if I said film specifically, but I said in the subject I love. And I thought, well, this is it. Like, I shocked myself, because I thought, okay, well, if you were this certain at like 9 or 8, 10 years old, then you should be certain now about where to go next. So that was a nice detail that kind of also was a little bit inspirational in a strange way.
Well, you're clearly a man on a mission. And my very last question: are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
That's a great question. I would say for me both. I think looking back, because of the film heritage, I tend to be a person that always looks. Not, I don't know if it's looking back, because I always relive these films as now. So it's always about the present. But I always think looking back is important, because I think people don't look back enough, especially, I mean, people who are my age or, like, you know, a generation, they don't, people always, I'm not sure even they look, if everyone looks always forward. It's, you know, they're always focused on what's happening now, but not in the best sense. I think it's important to be able to look back and to understand both, you know, where you're from, where you're going, in order to be able to act now. So that's kind of, but an important dimension of that is the courage and the hope that you can go forward. Yeah. So I hope, I mean, that's not, for me, it's always the hope of going forward. So, and that's not always, you know, sometimes things may seem uncertain, and this is the moment where you mentioned, I mean, suffering can come in. And I do mean, obviously, not about myself. I don't want to, whether I've had, you know, health experiences or things like that, where you see, you know, parts of that, and you see how, you know, how, frail human beings actually, you know, how frail we can be, and we are, that can be also a reinvigorating energy for moving.
Yeah, I mean, what a real privilege to catch up and see you. And I think you are a man on a mission. You've clearly got a long way to go, and, you know, in terms of following through on all these passions, and there's so much potential and so much that I'm excited to sort of, you know, to continue to be to chart and to witness, you know, all that there is to come. So thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you so much, and I love that you do this podcast. And I think, you know, the fact that you called it nostalgia, you have this connection with Tarkovsky. So I'm very happy and honored that you invited me to do this, and I really hope that we can continue the conversation, and that we can discover more films together.